Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed, so I call your name, your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg. This is my first interview back without Fran by my side, so it's a little weird. But we have a great guest tonight, so I'm going to introduce Dr. Ed Kelly. Ed is professor of research at the Division of Perceptual Studies in the Department of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. Dr. Kelly did his undergraduate work at Yale, got his PhD at Harvard, and co-authored several books. I mean, the first book was Beyond Physicalism, Toward Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality, and then came Irreducible Mind, Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century. And we're going to touch on a new book that's coming out. Unfortunately, it won't be out probably till around March of next year, but the title will be Consciousness Unbound, Liberating Mind from the Tyranny of Materialism. Dr. Kelly's interests include, among other things, mind-brain issues and cognitive neuroscience, phenomena that challenge current neuroscientific dogma, specifically involving altered states of consciousness and psi, and neurobiologically realistic models of human cognitive function, and research technologies that permit direct visualization of the activity of the working human brain. Welcome to Signs of Life, Ed. Glad to have you back with us.
Glad to be here, Bob. My task here is to talk about the forthcoming book, Consciousness Unbound, but I really want to talk about all three because they lead to a certain picture of things. And I especially want to take note of the fact that a lot of this stuff is very abstract and kind of remote from everyday human affairs. And I am acutely aware, even I have to say painfully aware, of the distance between that and the kind of extreme concrete human grief that you've had to deal with lately with Fran. And the kind of work that I do, I think, can become meaningful to the extent that it helps provide support.
Well,
to all of us in circumstances like the ones you've been dealing with. So I'll try to do that in what I say, but I hope maybe toward the end somewhere we can come back to that because, it's just my nature. I get excited about the kind of science nerdy stuff that I do. And I don't want to lose that thread in what we end up talking about.
Yeah. No, I understand.
So let me pile in.
Yeah.
I'll figure on talking for 30 minutes or something like that, and then maybe we take a little break and go on.
Yeah, well, and I'm acutely aware of, I mean, the work that you do and the work of others. I mean, all the disciplines of research that go to show that the mind can act independently of the brain provides the foundation for belief in survival. You know, because if the physical brain is not all there is, it gives you hope that your loved one still exists in some form. But we go back to the title of the new book, which I think is interesting. And, you know, when you say you know, liberating the mind from the tyranny of materialism. That's putting it right out there. So, I mean, you're in your previous writings and in the previous books and your research, you explore how we can unshackle our minds from our physical bodies. And then when you talk about the tyranny of materialism, I'm sure, you know, some of your colleagues will say, what are you talking about? It's materialism is all there is. So what do you say to people that insist that we're automatons, you know, we're walking computers and psi is impossible? How do you answer that?
Well, this is really the central subject of our first book, which was actually Irreducible Mind, not Beyond Physicalism.
Okay.
And let me say how this came about. Over the past several centuries, a certain picture of things has taken root in really all of the nominally advanced countries of the world. So it's not just mainstream scientists, but actually opinion elites all over the place who take seriously this so-called physicalist picture. And, I mean, it comes in a lot of flavors, but it basically says something like this. It says, in the end, all facts are determined by physical facts alone. Reality, it's out there. It consists at bottom of little bits of some kind of solid stuff moving around in fields of force in accordance with mathematical laws, and everything else has to come from that. That includes our conscious human minds. This picture leads inevitably to the idea that everything in mind and consciousness is manufactured by physiological processes going on in our brains. And if that picture is correct, then there can't be any survival, period. It's a delusion. But is it correct? Well, we certainly had hints from various places that it's not correct. I mean, for starters, the whole thing kind of stands on late 19th century physics. And developments in 20th century physics, which I won't talk about because I'm not qualified to, have completely undermined those basic ideas of, you know, a fixed space, a container in which all kinds of events take place in accordance with a universal time, that we can always tell which event precedes the other event and assign causality and all that kind of stuff. There's also been a lot of work in philosophy of mind, which has convinced a lot of people, including even some very prominent neuroscientists, that we're never going to be able to explain the properties of consciousness in physicalist terms. Things like our ability to speak about things in the world. Intentionality is the name of the philosophical concept there. The unity of conscious experience, most particularly its kind of qualitative feels and all that. A lot of people have given up. Even a guy like Christoph Koch, you know, Francis Crick's leading disciple, who in his autobiographical book, he says, I used to believe that consciousness is manufactured by brain processes. Look at my earlier books. But I no longer believe that. That's an amazing concession, and I think a step forward from a very prominent neuroscientist.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the stuff I want to talk about, though, has more to do with human psychobiological phenomena. And to get to the bottom of it, we really kind of have to go back to the beginnings of the whole subject, the relation between brain and mind. You know, everybody agrees that there are normally strong correlations between brain events and mental events. You know, if you get whacked on the head hard enough, or if you ingest a psychedelic or drink too much alcohol or something, your mental processes will change. That shows unequivocally that physical things can change mental things. But what about the other direction? Let's say I'm listening to a lecture by some physicalist and he says something I really object to, and I decide, by God, I'm going to raise my hand and ask him a question. And my hand goes up in the air. Now, isn't that an example of a mental thing causing a physical thing? Seems like it to most of us, most of the time.
Sure.
Well, the physicalist response to that is, well, sorry, you misunderstood what's really going on here, because that idea or intention of yours, you see, is really just a physiological process in your brain. So something physical causes something physical. That's what made your hand go up. No problem. Now, that's a very abstract kind of argument, and it's very hard to defeat. But the most direct way of trying to defeat it is to identify things that people can do that cannot be possibly be explained by the operations of the unaided brain. So this is where we get toward irreducible mind. The way this came about was that Mike Murphy, who's the co-founder of Esalen Institute, he had recognized very clearly that if physicalism is true, there can't be survival, period. But he also knew that there were a bunch of people around the world, including several of us at UVA, who are doing research that's producing evidence that specifically suggests that survival might be possible. So he decided to convene this group to discuss this evidence. And so we did. We did that for a couple of years. We went through a lot of the main lines of evidence. And, of course, there's a lot of it of many different kinds. And we got to a point where it was clear to us that we all are disbelievers in physicalism, and we wanted to attack it in a very general way. And so we set about to do that in kind of a two-stage process. So the first stage was really to try to assemble in one place a whole lot of evidence of the sort I just described, things that people can do, capabilities that we have that are difficult or impossible to explain in conventional physicalist terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what Irreducible Mind was all about. It's a huge book, and it was deliberately aimed at sort of advanced graduate students, advanced undergraduates, graduate students, and early sort of professional psychology and neuroscience faculty kinds of people. There are a lot of books out there that are sort of more popular in orientation, but we were really aiming at a more academic kind of audience in hopes of recruiting people, getting academic type people interested in the sort of work that we do. Anyway, what we did was we built a thing around the book that was published posthumously by F.W.H. Myers in 1903. Myers was one of the founders of the British Society for Psychical Research. And this wonderful book of his, Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death, he did essentially what we were trying to do. He had examined a number of phenomena that he felt couldn't be explained in materialist kind of terms. And so what we did basically was to review a whole bunch of these, revisit them in light of the subsequent, 100 plus years of biomedical research. So it's heavily loaded with all kinds of references to journal articles and, standard medical, biomedical, psychological journals. And we covered a bunch of topics. I won't try to go through it all. The book is 800 something pages long. But to give you just a couple of the highlights, one area is one that my wife Emily wrote a chapter about, extreme forms of psychophysical influence. Influences of mental processes on bodily stuff. So she started with kind of general vague sort of things like generic placebo effects, things like that, but worked her way gradually toward more and more extremely specific and precise effects that get harder and harder to explain in conventional biological terms. So to give you some examples of the more extreme ones, there are things like stigmata. These are things that occur in certain persons who are very emotionally involved with the crucifixion of Christ and who are able to visualize in apparently some kind of very intense way his wounds, and then develop corresponding kinds of deformations in their own bodies. So, marks of flogging on the forehead or spear wounds in the side, things of that sort. There are analogous things that occur under deep hypnosis, where a hypnotic virtuoso can be touched, for example, with a cool pointer that has at the tip of it the kind of shape of a star, and then having been told that the pointer is red hot, produces a blister of the same geometric shape. Now, we know how a hot geometric shape can produce a corresponding blister shape, but we have no idea how to do that from inside out, so to speak, how the idea of such a thing would produce the blister. And there are a bunch of other things, and she goes through a number of those, where there's no known mechanism in the nervous system that could possibly support the thing that's been observed and documented. So that's one large category of cases. So another part of that literature, by the way, is this stuff about hypnotic analgesia, where people can undergo really rather drastic operations with no anesthesia, just hypnosis. In particular, is a long report from a man named Esdale, who did this in India before there was any anesthesia and operated on tumors and things like that. I mean, the descriptions of those things are just absolutely grisly. You can hardly imagine how anybody could possibly have stood it, and yet they do. In fact, they show little sign of discomfort as he's doing these terrible things to them. So that's one big area. Another one that I'm particularly interested in concerns near-death experiences, and in particular, near-death experiences that occur under extreme physiological conditions. I'm talking about things like deep general anesthesia and or cardiac arrest. Our colleague at DOPS, the Division of Perceptual Studies at UVA, this is Bruce Grayson, is probably the major figure in that world. He has about 1,000 cases altogether in his collection, and several hundred of those are of this type, involving general anesthesia and or cardiac arrest. Now, the whole point of anesthesia, of course, is to make you not feel anything and not remember anything. In fact, surgeons and anesthesiologists go to great lengths to make sure that that's what happens, because if people wake up in the normal way, it's catastrophic for them and has legal and so on consequences for the doctors. So normally people do not wake up in the normal way. However, it's come to light, thanks to the work by Bruce and others, that a fair proportion, on the order of maybe 10 or 15% of people undergoing cardiac arrest, for example, during surgical cardiac operations, will report afterward having had not only some experience, but the most powerful and transformative experience of their entire lives. Now, these are important in many ways, but from my point of view as a neuroscientist, the really critical one is that conditions like general anesthesia and cardiac arrest obliterate conditions in the brain that virtually all neuroscientists believe must be there in order for there to be any experience. I don't want to go down into the weeds here too much, but the basic idea is that the brain has to be able to generate oscillatory activity, you know, waves, brain waves at frequencies in the 10 to, say, 40 hertz range that can be connected across big cortical areas. That's the leading theory about the neurophysiological underpinnings of consciousness. And that is just gone, particularly after cardiac arrest. And yet these experiences occur. And how do we know they're occurring then? Because in some of the cases, patients report things that happened during the period of time when they were apparently unconscious. Things which, in some cases, many cases actually, on the order of 100 at least, can be verified as having actually happened. So, this in particular, I think, supports a different understanding of the connection between brain and mind. It's one that was actually advanced by William James in 1897 at the Ingersoll Lectures at Harvard. He called it the transmission or permission theory. The idea is that, yeah, brain events and mind events are correlated, But that doesn't mean that the brain events are causing the mental events. It may be that the conditions in the brain simply permit the expression of something mental that is functionally distinct from the brain, and the operations of which depend on conditions in the brain. So it's a kind of mind and brain side by side. They can be functionally and even maybe ontologically distinct. And this was really the theory that was being advanced by Myers. James kind of took it over and proceeded to elaborate and extend it in his late philosophical work. But the really crucial thing here is that picture, if that picture is correct, and we argue in Irreducible Mind that there's more evidence now for that than there was in Myers and James's time, and it fits better, actually, with leading-edge developments in both physics and neuroscience, encompasses a wider range of facts than the conventional view. It also opens a path to survival, because mind and consciousness are no longer being produced by brain processes, but conditioned by them. The conditions in the brain sort of alter the way the mind operates, but doesn't create what's in the mind and consciousness. That's a huge step. It eliminates what's been called the biological objection to survival, bypasses it completely, and makes the evaluation of the evidence for survival dependent more strictly on just the quality of that evidence itself. Yeah. And let me say here that in my own opinion, were it not for this kind of biological objection stuff, the prevailing physicalism, the evidence would be more than sufficient to convince most people that survival is a reality. Most of us, including me, I mean, historically, I've been held back by that biological objection. But the effort of writing Irreducible Mind really altered my whole perspective on that. I think that's probably the correct way to think about the brain-mind relation, and it really does make survival not only unobjectionable logically, but more probable empirically.
Well,
I didn't say that terribly well, but that's kind of how I feel about it. In fact, at this point, really, I think the thing that probably holds us back most is not the evidence at all, but the lack of a generally agreed upon theory that can make sense of the evidence that we have. And that really brings us to the next book, Beyond Physicalism, where we try to do just that. We try to ask ourselves, and when I say we here, we're talking now about a group of maybe 20 or 30 people at a time, all working on these things together. And from many disciplines, we had physicists, biologists, scholars of religion, philosophers, historians of science. The goal was to try to imagine how reality must really be constituted, as opposed to the way the physicalists say it is, in order that these various kinds of things that we cataloged in Irreducible Mind can happen. And so we had contributions from a bunch of different areas. We had several physicists, a quantum theorist, a relativity theorist, several scholars of religion talking about mystically informed religious philosophies like Neoplatonism, Patanjali and yoga, the Kashmir Shaivism of the 11th, 12th centuries, and several philosophers talking about semi-modern, anyhow, philosophical systems. Leibniz's monadology was one. Charles Sanders Peirce, another. Whitehead, a third. All of whom, took these phenomena seriously and tried to account for them within their theoretical system. So we actually had a total of about 11 of these in Beyond Physicalism. And toward the end, we arrived at a sort of rough consensus, heading in a kind of an idealist sort of direction. I mean, it's almost the exact opposite of physicalism. you know, physicalism says basically there's this little hard stuff at the bottom and everything comes from that. Idealism says essentially that all there is really is consciousness and everything comes from that. I want to get back to that a little bit later. But let me first say a little bit what I'm supposed to be talking about, which is consciousness unbound. It really carries forward both of the themes of the previous books. We have a first section, which is empirical, where Bruce Grayson presents a kind of state of the science survey of near-death experiences. Jim Tucker does the same thing for cases of the reincarnation type, you know, where little kids are reporting memories of a previous life that you can check up on. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful chapter on precognition by another member of our CIRSEM group that I think carries that subject further. Then we got five more theories of types closely similar to the ones that we had presented in Beyond Physicalism, but getting even a little narrower in terms of the you know, the sort of breadth of the span of these things. They're closer together than the ones in Beyond Physicalism. And then in the last part of the book, we actually try to move at least a little bit in the direction of what will it mean for various parts of the world if we agree to move collectively in this kind of theoretical direction. So there's a chapter of the impact, the possible impact on the science of consciousness. Another one on how we practice the humanities. This is by Jeff Kripal, who's a scholar of religion. I mean, ironically, physicalism has penetrated all of the humanities, even religious studies, to the extent that something over half of the Academy of Religion apparently consists of physicalists who are trying to produce reductive explanations of all kinds of religious experience. And then the final chapter in the book, which I think is a real tour de force, is one by Paul Marshall, my co-editor, in which he surveys the whole theoretical landscape. I mean, he really does an absolutely unbelievable job of integrating all this stuff. So I'm quite excited about the new book. I should say I also have a little epilogue at the end where I try to say in more personal terms what I think it all adds up to. And this is kind of taking me back to where we started this, because I think we can begin to see, well, first of all, I think we can see clearly now that physicalism it's finished. Very few people would accept that statement, but I think it's clear that it is, and it's going to become increasingly clear in the very near future to a whole lot more people. There are, you know, rumblings of discontent everywhere. And I think we can see, at least in kind of broad outline, the kind of different worldview or conceptual framework or metaphysical system that will replace it eventually. Mm. And whatever that turns out to be in detail, I think it will almost certainly include postmortem survival as one of its accepted phenomena. Let me just say one more thing because about this theory stuff before we get back to connections with real experience. You know, I grew up, when I was in graduate school, physicalism was just kind of the atmosphere you breathe. It was never discussed. It was just there. It was kind of it was like water for fish. It was the assumed background understanding of how things are. Mm-hmm. And I was only dislodged from that when I came across a guy shortly after getting my PhD who could do all kinds of psychic tasks, experimental tasks. And I understood right away that these things should not happen if the physicalism I had grown up with and sort of passively absorbed, if it were true. But there it was. I couldn't ignore it. At the same time, I, like many other people, I think, who come into the field from the scientific side, really hoped that some minor adjustment somewhere in our scheme of things would take care of these problems. Well, I've become more and more convinced as time goes by that that's not the way it's going to be, that we have to really radically overhaul our most basic ideas about how things are at bottom. And I've grudgingly, reluctantly, slowly convinced myself that once you abandon conventional physicalism, there's really no place to stop, short of what amounts to its exact opposite, some kind of idealism. Now, idealism, you know, I mean, it was all the rage until the end of the 19th century, and then was quickly obliterated, particularly in the UK, by people like Russell and Moore, and has hardly been heard from since. But there are now rumblings of increased, renewed interest in idealisms. And what I want to say about that is one feature of that situation that was particularly critical for me, and where I was finally able to overcome a barrier to moving in that direction. And it's this. There's a subtle but really important asymmetry between the challenges to physicalists and idealists. The challenge to the physicalists is, how do you explain consciousness? How do you explain how physical processes can give rise to consciousness? And as talked about earlier, there's increasing agreement that physicalism really cannot explain consciousness. But, says the physicalist, look, you guys, you idealists, you have exactly the opposite problem. How do you explain matter? Now, at first, that's a really tough objection, but the more I thought about it, the more I came to realize that it's not right. There's this subtle asymmetry, because what the idealist has to explain is not matter as classically conceived under the physicalist scheme of things, but rather the regularities of experience that the physicalist picture was invented to explain. I'm not sure I said that terribly clearly, but I think that's a really important thing. And when I finally got onto that, I was able to make this move in my own sort of philosophical thinking, which was really very hard for me. I mean, we're all of us who have grown up in the last 50 years or whatever we've been steeped in this physicalist viewpoint from the time we were little kids in our elementary school, high school, college, whatever. And it's very hard to shake. I mean, it goes a long way toward providing us with a kind of satisfactory account of how things are. But it's become clear now, at this point in time, that it's not going to do the whole job. It's got fatal limitations, and we're going to have to find something different to take its place. Anyway, so that's the whole kind of theory scheme, and I really like this new book, actually. I think it's a better book than Beyond Physicalism, and might really have some impact, partly because it's got some people in it who have never kind of been publicly on board about topics of this sort before. A guy like Max Velmans, for example, is a very prominent guy in consciousness studies. He's got a chapter in there. We've got a wonderful guy named Federico Fagin, who's a microelectronics pioneer, a physicist, Italian physicist, living in Silicon Valley for the past 50 years, who invented a bunch of the early microprocessors, built them. A major guy in that world who began having mystical experiences spontaneously about 30 years ago, realized immediately that they had to alter his most basic ideas about how things are, and has been trying to work out his own scheme for that ever since. Bernardo Kastrup is another guy. He's a sort of independent one-man army producing books at the rate of about one a year on metaphysical subjects, advocating idealism, opposing physicalism. So these are all sort of new characters in our scheme of things, and I think they add a lot to the solidity of the book. We also have a good chapter that kind of reels Carl Jung in much closer to the main cluster of the theories that we've been discussing in these last two books. So that's my pitch for the books.
Yeah. Well, I think that you know, it's wonderful that, you know, DOPS has broadened its horizons, you know, because, you know, it's not just, you know, studying NDEs and past life memories in children. And as you mentioned, you have social scientists, you have biologists, you have religious scholars and philosophers, and down the list. So you're approaching it from many different angles, which you have to do if you're going to change worldview about these things. So I think that's a great step in the right direction. I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to digest. You mentioned Myers and the, you know, the brain is a filter model. And I remember, you know, reading his books, you know, long ago, and that model really resonated with me. I really believe that that's true, you know, that the brains don't generate consciousness, but they constrain the mind. And I'm relating it to my personal experience, you know, with Fran, which was, it kind of hit home, because when the disease ultimately made its way and compromised her brain, but I knew from looking in her eyes that her mind was still very much intact, and she was fighting mightily to be able to express her thoughts. But the mechanism that allowed the thoughts to be expressed was severely damaged. But at the same time, I know she was having visions, including seeing deceased loved ones, and she was getting information, and she was trying her best to be able to verbalize it. So what's intriguing to me is, you know, if science can find a way to better enable us to bypass the brain, so to speak, and plug directly into a higher consciousness. I mean, is that a reasonable wish?
Bob, I think that is really the major horizon of the kind of work that we're doing, to try to learn more about conditions in the brain that permit expression of these higher capacities. And I think we can do that. I mean, for example, you know, there's a kind of renaissance in psychedelic research, including a lot of neuroimaging research, which is already producing very surprising results. And it gives us an opportunity to essentially study mystical experiences experimentally and find out what kind of brain conditions accompany those experiences. I mean, this was Myers' big thing, you know, about the, he spoke about the supraliminal self, the ordinary consciousness, and the subliminal self, which is this wider, more comprehensive consciousness. And he spoke about the emergence of the subliminal in proportion to the abeyance of the supraliminal. And this is exactly what you're talking about, that the whatever brain conditions kind of keep us anchored in this ordinary everyday reality, they have to somehow go away in a way that permits these other things to come in. And I think that's something we can really learn a lot about using standard scientific methods. And it's the real frontier, I think, for further work.
And I guess, you know, you feel there's some value in doing brain research on intuitive people like mediums, for example.
For sure.
Okay. One thing that many of our listeners might be surprised to know that is that John Cleese, yes, John Cleese of Monty Python fame and everything else, is actually has a very keen interest in the phenomena that you study. So how did you meet him and discover his interest in this stuff?
He just showed up at one of our first meetings at Esalen. This was back around 1999, I guess. And he actually came to the first several years of those meetings with his now ex-wife. And we just hit it off instantly. He's an absolutely wonderful guy, and he's even funnier in person than he is, you know, in public. And we've been in touch with him ever since. In fact, he's now a member of our DOPS advisory board, and he's written a jacket blurb for Consciousness Unbound. Yeah, it goes way back to his undergraduate days. He was at Cambridge, and he told us about one weekend he and a bunch of his buddies went off to some hotel somewhere and were, you know, partying and carrying on and so on, and started doing some card guessing or something. And he, I think he was an undergraduate in psychology, knew something about statistics, and he realized right away that he was doing way better than chance would expect. And he's been interested ever since. And it's a deep interest of his, for sure.
Yeah, and people, they can actually Google you and John Cleese. You'll see he's participated in some interviews with you and panel discussions.
Oh, that's right. He actually came and visited DOPS. When was that? Last 2019, I guess it was. Yeah, last year, maybe May or so. And, yeah, we sat and did a couple of interviews with him. Jim Tucker and I both chatted with him about this and that.
Yeah.
He's great. And he also emceed. We did a panel actually talking about DOPS's research at the Paramount Theater here in Charlottesville, and John was the MC for that. There's a video of that on the DOPS website.
Yeah, I know. I've watched it, and it's very informative and entertaining. So when we talk about going back to, survival or bodily death, it's a really – I don't know whether science is ever going to, really prove it in a laboratory. I mean, I don't know if we can ever overcome the super psi, explanation. But, so the people that say that intuitive people or mediums, are not necessarily communicating with discarnates, but they're pulling information out of a field of information, whatever you want to call that field.
Mm-hmm.
But that argument itself flies in the face of materialistic science, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, basically what we have is a kind of dilemma. Is it survival or is it some kind of super-duper psi interactions among only living persons? And from the conventional point of view, both of those are anathema. They don't want to pick one or the other. Want to sort of quarantine both, get them out of the way, pretend that everything's all right scientifically. I'm a little more optimistic than you are, Bob, about this living agent psi versus survival thing.
Yeah.
Because it's not just information that we're talking about. I mean, in the best cases, like some of the classic mediumship cases, you have what really seems like the full-blooded impersonation of the deceased person, not just facts that they know, but things like demeanor, diction, sense of humor, emotional concerns, the evidence of purpose in a lot of the apparitional cases and mediumship cases, the seeming intent of the communicating spirit to convey something to someone, to accomplish some purpose. Those kinds of things, I think, tilt the balance toward the side of survival. And, now with this, I think we've basically established the likelihood that the filter or permission or transmission picture of the brain-mind relation is correct. I think the evidence we have really goes a long way toward establishing the reality of survival. The court work, the rebirth studies, are also, I think, a powerful new component of the overall body of survival research. And they're getting better and better. Jim has, of course, some wonderful American cases now.
Yeah.
And new ones are constantly turning up.
Yeah, and I think really, when it comes to your work and some of your colleagues, I remember what Bruce Grayson said at one of our early conferences when he summarized everything at the end. He said, it's very easy to take any one of these disciplines of research that we talked about during the conference and dismiss them.
Mm-hmm.
But when you step back and you examine all of the areas of research as a whole, then the only logical conclusion you can come to is that we survive physical death. So you can't dismiss everything. Although materialists try, but I think that's the advantage of having such a broad perspective. We're able to step
Absolutely.
Back the whole.
I mean, for example, in the arena of near-death experiences, whenever one of us talks about some paranormal occurrence, you know, like a patient reporting something that happened at a distance, the typical response of the skeptics is to try to deny that, basically by confining attention only to that and the imperfections of any such anecdotal event,
yeah,
and ignoring the very large body of experimental research that demonstrates the existence of psi phenomena as a reality. They try to sort of divide and conquer, basically.
Uh-huh.
But as Bruce argued, you've really got to take the whole body of evidence, all of its dimensions together in order to have a chance of getting the correct picture.
Yeah. It also strikes me odd, and I remember this as you were talking before, is that, you know, I've had conversations over the years with some scientists that are grounded in materialist thinking. And when I asked them whether they personally, you know, believed in God or a designed universe, almost all of them answered that they do. And yet the same scientists will fight tooth and nail in their professional careers to refute the evidence that the mind is separate from the brain. So, you know, it's hard to reconcile, you know.
There's a wonderful quote from William James. It was one of his early papers. He pointed out, this is about like 1895 or something. He says, good materialist scientists in their laboratories by day, good Christian fathers and husbands in their homes at night, thus holding loosely the two ends of a chain, they are careless of the intermediate connection. And I think that's still true today.
I think so.
You've identified the exact same phenomenon. And I agree. I've seen a bunch of surveys that say like 30 or 40% of practicing scientists who claim to be materialist scientists, basically, also have some kind of a religious practice that they subscribe to.
You know, ultimately, and maybe it culminates with the next book, Consciousness Unbound, is that what all of the research comes down to, it's basically aimed towards the answer to one question, and that is, do we live in a meaningful and purposeful universe or not?
Absolutely.
I think that's really where you're headed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are a few. Let me say first of all that I think there are a relatively small number of people who have basically made a living out of being professional debunkers of all kinds of paranormal evidence of one sort or another. I mean, James Randi, who just died, is probably the premier example, contemporary example. I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but that guy he was a very dishonest person.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in a barbershop in Duke University campus back in 1975 or 76, getting a haircut, and he comes on to one of these morning TV shows and proceeds to misdescribe the remote viewing experiments of Targ and Puthoff with Uri Geller in such a way as to permit him to claim that he knew how the results had been fraudulently produced. I couldn't believe it. He just stood there and lied. He knew what the truth of the matter was, and he changed it. I thought, this is a bad dude here.
Yeah, well, he could have been.
I saw nothing ever since that changed my mind about that. And there are people like that who are out there. I mean, partly it's a way of making a living, for one thing. You get a lot of attention and publicity and, you know, opportunities to make money, I suppose, and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
There are also quite a few people for whom this physicalist worldview is a kind of a secular religion. And just like, adherence to other faiths, they get mad when their faith is challenged. I think the facts of the matter are becoming so overwhelming at this point that we are bound to to see some kind of a major inflection point in intellectual history that basically pitches the physicalist worldview and replaces it with something very different. And I think we're kind of getting toward a consensus on what that alternative will look like. That's kind of where things stand at the moment.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't hesitate. My personal bet is that after I die physically, I will still be conscious in some form. I don't know if I'll recognize continuity with my previous form, but I do think something of me is going to persist. It's not a certainty by any means, but I think the weight of evidence points in that direction.
And you'll probably still be participating in research, just without a body.
Who knows?
Yeah,
could be a great adventure.
Have you studied meditation? You know, in the laboratory setting. I mean,
we haven't, but that's one of our primary interests, actually. I have to confess, I did a lot of meditation late in graduate school, and for the first couple of years thereafter, I just got out of the practice. But I had gone far enough with it to be convinced that these guys are really onto something, that you can really alter the way your mind functions through meditation. I had a couple of experiences that are probably quite trivial in the grand scheme of things, but boy, they sure impressed me. So sudden, spectacular changes in the way my consciousness related to my surroundings. And of course, there's this vast literature and tradition relating advancements in meditation to the emergence of all kinds of psychic skills and that sort of thing. Although there's often also sort of injunctions not to get too preoccupied with this stuff, because it can just be a distraction and deflect you from what should be the real objective of your spiritual practice. That's very prominent in Patanjali, for example. He's got a sutra directed to that subject.
We're
real interested in finding, skilled meditators who are willing to participate in research, both to study the meditation itself in terms of accompanying brain processes, and also to study its association with, for example, psi skills and that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's always a debate of, what has a more profound effect on someone. I mean, learning about research and being aware of the scientific evidence, or having a personal experience. I mean, you yourself, you were jolted from your materialist thinking, by a firsthand encounter. So, I mean, I think it's a combination of the two. I think that the science and the research opens the door and makes one more receptive to recognize an encounter when it comes, instead of dismissing it. And that's part of the value of science, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Yeah. All right. So I know we're coming to the end of our time. I just want to mention again, the first book, and as Ed mentioned, it's about 800 pages. I mean, I tackled it many years ago, and it took quite a long time, but I really dove into the material, and it's really probably the most comprehensive book of its kind ever. So, Irreducible Mind Towards Psychology for the 21st Century. The second book, Beyond Physicalism, Toward Reconciliation of Science and Spirituality. And Keep Your Eyes Open for Consciousness Unbound, Liberating Mind from the Tyranny of Materialism. And you can look up the work, we call it DOPS, the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. So you can Google that, look it up, see about all the other work that they do, and of course follow the work of Dr. Kelly. Ed, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Look forward to talking with you again soon.
Well, good. And Bob, gosh, I hope you're doing okay, man.
Yeah, well, we always used to say, Fran and I, it is what it is. So that's pretty much, you can't there were certain things she always told me, don't get so upset over the things that you can't control, I'm trying to heed that lesson, but, mm-hmm. It's not that easy. So, thanks and, have a good night and we'll talk soon.
Okay, Bob. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. And I'd like to end by continuing the global peace prayer that Fran used to read. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, and to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And with that, I'd say good night, everyone, and thanks for joining us tonight.